when the opportunity comes, I see if I check in with my gut. Does it sound exciting? Does it sound like an adventure? Does it sound like something I haven't done yet? And if that gut says I want to say yes, I want to explore like that's like, I just take the leap and I go. I don't necessarily plan everything out because what I planned turns out to be much more limited than the adventure would be. Mm. And that's the path I've followed as an adult in my career. And it's taken me to places I never would have expected.
This is Finding the Throughline, the show that gives you inside access to honest conversations about the creative process. I'm Kate Hanley. Welcome back to Finding the Throughline, conversations about the creative process, where this week I am interviewing screenwriter, public speaker, and writer Sarah Montana. As a refresher, Sarah has written multiple movies for the Hallmark Channel, including Rescuing Christmas and Love to the Rescue. And her TEDx talk, The Real Risk of Forgiveness and Why It's Worth It, is one of my all-time favorites. Today, I'm talking with Sarah about what I call inner stuff, the thoughts, ideas, and attitudes that affect your work, even if you're not fully conscious of it. So, Sarah, I'm curious, are there any parts of writing and sharing your work that just kind of give you the heebie-jeebies? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Absolutely. You know, the heebie-jeebies for me come from, it's been a hard learned lesson. You brought up the TED Talk in terms of when you put things out there that are deeply personal and that have a lot of trauma, I don't have any problems sharing. It's funny, most people I think are afraid to hit send or afraid to hit share. I was not, because you're like, what will people think of me? I wasn't actually worried about what people would think about me. I was like, if it helps one person, great. If 5 million people tell me I'm a moron, but one person is like, oh, I might change my life and live it a little bit for the better, I was very comfortable with that. I wasn't prepared for the level of personal attention and what we call like parasocial relationships, and how when your work transforms someone's life or their perspective, the relationship that they attach to you, even though you don't have any experience of that person, that was a really... it's scarier than they prepare you for. I have to be honest.
Is this kind of like we all feel like we sort of know our favorite celebrities type of thing? And if we see them on the street, we're going to approach them as if we like are buddies with years long history. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And it's the when you're writing about the things that are like the most personal or talking about the things that are the most personal things that have ever happened to you. And they're these big, I mean, obviously for me, I'm talking about murder. I'm talking about gun violence. I'm talking about sexual assault. The thing they feel connected to you, the wound that's healed in them, is this incredibly intense wound, most likely. And so there are people, like at the beginning of this process, if you had told me, hey, you're going to get like hundreds of letters from people who say, I was going to, trigger warning, sorry, commit suicide. And then I watched your talk. And now I'm seeing that there's another path forward. And I just wanted to say thank you. On the one hand, that is the most beautiful message you can ever receive. And it's so powerful. And I am so grateful for those things. And that's like 80% of the emotional equation. But there is a 20% when you're getting the story of the worst things that have happened to people over and over and over again, where you're sharing your work with the world and hoping it will be healing. And it is, but what you're getting back is more awareness of the problem and like how much pain and suffering is out there in the world. And you're like, I'm glad it's better now. I didn't know that this thing existed before you told me about the end results. So now I'm also having to live through the trauma of catching up to the point that you are now as you tell me your whole story. I wasn't prepared for that. And I probably needed a stronger support system around me before the TED Talk went like semi-viral. It's got like over 1 million views, but there was another one that Goalcast picked up that has like over 100 million views. And that one got crazy. And I think it's one of those things where it's like, that's what you hope will happen until it happens. And I would not change it for the world because I'm very proud of the impact that those things have had. But it's made me think a lot about how comfortable I feel and what is my role in the work that I'm happiest with. I feel happiest when I can write a piece and send it into the world. And like, people don't really have an association with me, the person on the street, that the work gets to just be the work and that it gets to be very personal to the audience and they get to carry it with them and it gets to be wholly, completely theirs. The idea of having to be a like famous persona around this thing, I'm completely disenchanted and completely disavowed that like I don't need to be Elizabeth Gilbert. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to be Cheryl Strayed. And I think that's part of the appeal of film. And here's the thing I'll say is if it would help a lot of people, I would do it. But it would be the shit sandwich that came with it. Mm-hmm. Not the fun of doing it. Of being like, what's her name? Oh, We Can Do Hard Things, her podcast.
Oh, I'm blanking. Glennon Doyle.
Yes. Like that kind of thing I think over time would be really hard for me. But the thing about like the Christmas movies, for example, is one of the movies I did was Two Turtle Doves. And it was a Christmas movie about grief. It was about how hard it is to get through the holidays when you've lost mm-hmm. someone. It's a, you know, Nikki DeLoach gets to be the face of that. And Michael Rady gets to be the face of that. And then there are still people reaching out to me, but because the characters were fictionalized, because it's not my personal experience, there is a little bit of remove. And there's also, I'm finding lately, sorry, this is so much more than you asked for. I used to write a lot of like memoir and I'm still doing it. I still want to write essays. And I think it's an incredibly powerful, important form. And I do a lot of thinking about how to write about trauma in a way that is both healing for you and your audience and the boundaries around that. And mm-hmm. I'm in a phase right now that won't last forever. I'm sure I'll go back to memoir, but writing about things that have happened to me and allowing it to be fiction so that I can rewrite the story how I wish it had happened, both in good and bad ways. So I can like knock the crap out of this person in the in the fictionalized version of this, or we can have the knockdown drag out fight and I can say the things that I didn't get to say, or we can have the conversation that actually heals the thing. And that person can like, I'm finding a lot more solace and a lot more energy and a lot more healing in that right now than in trying to stick to the truth of this, or the emotional truth of the situation has become more important than the facts of how things played out. And so that's something as I put things out in the world that I'm thinking about more and more is like, how can you create things that have maximum healing impact, but the least amount of ego or personal attachment to me? Because then I get to keep my life. Yeah, I don't know if you read the Britney memoir, but that's important.
It's on my list. I haven't read it yet.
Ooh, doggy. I'm still thinking about it. It is haunting.
Oh, I know my daughter asked for it for Christmas and I'm trying to decide. Do I buy that book for her? I'm not sure.
Do it. You know what I will say? And this is like so off topic, but I think it is in her work. As somebody who grew up with her as, like, I was the prime target audience for Britney Spears, right? Like, I was in sixth grade when Baby One More Time came out. I watched everything she went through. And there is this thing in feminism that we have, that the girl boss culture, right? That really dominated probably like your coming of age and my coming of age. Mm-hmm. We've seen it at dinner parties you and I have both been at. This book was an important reminder that misogyny runs deeper than our society's trappings of security. And so you can be the most famous and one of the wealthiest women in the world and one of the most powerful. And she still somehow found herself enslaved, like literally enslaved for 10 years. And mm-hmm. so like, what does it mean to actually be free? What does it mean to actually be free as a woman? What does it mean to be safe? And the balance between the inner world where you have to cultivate that and the external world that doesn't want you to have that freedom. I think, I'm not sure Britney Spears is approaching the material that way. She's just telling us her story. Mm-hmm. But I walked away more haunted by it and thinking more about those themes in ways that made me think about what are my goals, really? Like, what does it actually mean to live a free life? And maybe it's because it's coming on the heels of the strike, too, and having to grapple with these forces that be where I have to go back to work with people, not directly, but my bosses, 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 were people who were being quoted in the press saying, yeah, we want this to drag out till October so that writers are losing their houses and they'll come back on their knees begging and they'll take the deal we want, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think reading the Britney memoir and strike coinciding at the same time, and I thought this is way too deep, but I've also thought a lot about the kid who killed my mother and brother was 17. He had a gun in his hand. He'd never killed anyone. He didn't have a history of violence. He had a history of breaking into houses, not even breaking into houses. He would go door to door and jiggle doorknobs and see if anybody had their house unlocked. I think a lot about like, what is this moment as a teenager where you go from never really being violent to killing two people? And I think it's about an instrument of power being in your hands and the temptation of seeing how far that power extends is like so intoxicating that you can't stop yourself, essentially. And that's what I felt with the CEOs during this strike in a completely different way. I don't think they wanted to kill us. Like, I don't think that's what's happening there. But yeah. We have a system where like the intoxication of power is rewarded. And really everybody's trying to check and see where's the limit of this thing, where's the limit of this thing, where's the limit. By the time you get to the limit, sometimes you've done incalculable damage and it's hard to right the ship at that point. And so I think, anyway, that's a long way of saying that the Britney memoir and the violence in that memoir coinciding with strike and all these other things has made me think a lot about systems of power and our personal relationships to power and what delusions we've grown up with about how power exists. And well, if I just make enough money, then I'll have money means choices and money means safety.
So I love that discussing Britney Jean and her life and work and trauma led us to like this kind of bigger picture idea about how power is intoxicating and our systems of society are kind of set up to reward this power and reward the pushing of boundaries with this power. So you were kind of talking about how that is something that you have become aware of as a collective belief that you wish you want to explore. And I can't wait to read your work on it because now my wheels are turning for sure. I'm curious, are there other either collective illusions that you wish we would wake up from, or is there something that you were taught and like kind of bought into as a young person that you have come to realize is basically a crock of shit? And if so, how have you kind of, what has the process of rewriting that belief looked like?
You know, I think this one is going to be relatable, but I was a hyperachievement oriented kid and not in the typical like Alex Dunphy straight A student. Like I was also a little bit of a rebel, but I had teenage parents who, you know, one of them got into UVA. They both got into UVA. My mom also got into like these big Northeastern schools, but she had me when she was 17, when she was a senior in high school. And a lot of my parents' philosophy, you know, in raising me was about making sure that I had the power to go change the world, that I wouldn't be limited, that I would go to college and get a master's degree and do all these things. And it was coupled with this message of service, right? Like achievement will help you get to a position of power to help people. And those two things combined are like the most important thing you could ever do. And I think I internalized this idea that there would be achievements or things I would do that would, I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but I think we all deep down have this. I just thought something was going to unlock like almost like a video game character, like light would pour out of my skull and I would ascend and suddenly I would know true happiness and like full enlightenment. And there would just be these milestones where I would go, yes, this was all worth it for these things. And one of the other crocks that I internalized and then have had to discard in my life is this idea that career paths are linear. My career path has been so nonlinear and that's thank God because of my grandmother. This is like for the kids who are children of divorce. It is terrible for you now, but your children are going to love it because I had six grandparents instead of four. And one of them was Grand Sarah, who never had children of her own, never wanted kids, complete girl boss, worked in healthcare administration forever and ever and ever, and was a huge public speaker, and then went on to be a consultant to Deloitte after retirement, and then went back. You know, she's just like, but she always told me as a kid, but she made her career choices just basically based on, it wasn't necessarily, and then I do this, and then I do this, and then I do this, and then I do this. She was really clear that she was like, when the opportunity comes, I see if I check in with my gut. Does it sound exciting? Does it sound like an adventure? Does it sound like something I haven't done yet? And if that gut says, I want to say yes, I want to explore like that's like, I just take the leap and I go. I don't necessarily plan everything out because what I planned turns out to be much more limited than the adventure would be. And that's the path I've followed as an adult in my career. And it's taken me to places I never would have expected. I didn't think I would be a screenwriter. I didn't think I would be a public speaker. Even though when I look back, that makes sense based on who I was personality-wise. But I really did think that if I could have this big healing moment with art, if I had something that made like millions of people feel better, I just thought that it would change my life in this really big, dramatic way. And I felt very much the same afterwards. Yeah, I just felt like I was the same person. And now almost like a game on your phone where you unlock something and you've been doing all this stuff. And it's like, great, now here's the next level. And I was like, I had to have this big wake up moment where I went, oh, everything might feel like that for the rest of your life. If you're not careful. If you're not careful, you may be like, and the next achievement, and the next achievement, and the next achievement, and it might all just sort of be one thing after another, and you might not feel any of it, and it all could go away in a second, and it all could, none of it's going to have the effect that you want it to have on you. So yeah, I had to have a big like internal moment around that and mm-hmm. really think about like, what is my life versus what is my work? And what is the role of achievement of that? And the strike was kind of the perfect storm for that, because like Hannah Arendt talks about that pyramid where there's labor, which are the little things we have to do to stay alive. There's work, which are the things that pay for our ability to do our labor. And in our culture, we've gotten really stuck on work as our source of identity, but there should be this top of the pyramid that's citizen. Like, who am I in my community? And the strike was an opportunity to be a person in my community, not just the worker. And that, I think, brought a lot of peace and meaning. And I ended up doing like WJ Council, and it's made me think more about my own political engagement, but also just like, where am I channeling achievement? What are the most meaningful things you can do? I had parents who were very active in local politics, and my mom was like this incredible stay-at-home mom who was also this big volunteer. And people really diminished her as if like, oh, if only she had dead kids and she'd gone to the Ivy League school and done all these things. But she had 2,500 people at her funeral, and I'm not sure that that would be true of me right now. So yeah, I think that's part of the crack, is that there's this path that makes you more of a real person. Mm-hmm. And you're real every second that you're alive with every choice that you make. There's nothing you can do or not do that will make you any less valid as a contributing member of a society, or your life doesn't start or have more meaning at any particular part. Every beat of it is your life. And they're all kind of the same at the end of the day, if you zoom out far enough.
Mm. All right. Well, I'm really excited to hear about where kind of these rewriting this crock, you know, and realizing that it's not just about unlocking the next level of achievement is leading you next. That is what we are talking about in Friday's episode. So come back, everybody. Finding the Throughline airs one interview per week, broken up into three episodes that come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free. Skip the ads and get each interview in one longer episode by becoming a paid subscriber at katehanley.substack.com. Even if you aren't ready to get out your wallet just yet, become a free subscriber at katehanley.substack.com and receive the full show notes with links to everything my guests and I cover. However you listen, thank you. Finding the Throughline is edited by Sound Advice Strategies. Connect with me on Instagram at Kate Hanley Author. Here's a little preview of what's to come in part three of this interview.
You're going to get up close and personal with your idols at some point and realize that like they just have a different set of struggles than you do, but they also have a lot of struggles. Like, it's complicated. And so I don't like holding people up as a standard anymore.
I'm Kate Hanley, and this is Finding the Throughline. More to come on Friday.